handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman, see you at over.
Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, see you at out.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie, 435-921. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie, 473-989er, out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds HEBT. TOT 53.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Denise Simon Experience, and thanks for joining us on WDDQ Talk 92.1. I want to introduce you to Daniel Street. Daniel is a lawyer and an author. And he's been doing some remarkable work here, paying lots of attention to what's happening across the country, especially when it comes to news and legal stuff. You can find him over at Fake News Exposed on Substack. And Daniel's been kind enough to join us to talk about blocking Trump from these ballots in, several states. But Daniel Street, welcome. Nice to have you.
Hey, thank you for having me on. Glad to be here.
It's remarkable to me that these secretaries of state and a handful of states across the country are taking this position to keep Trump off the ballot for insurrection when there was no insurrection, right? Do these secretaries of state not talk to each other?
Well, number one, you are right, and I agree completely about the fact there was not an insurrection on January 6th. I have an entire chapter of Volume 1 of Fake News Exposed about Trump dedicated to that precise issue, and I can tell you that legally and with respect to what insurrection means for purposes of federal law, that January 6th was not an insurrection. That's why none of the over 1,000 people charged with crimes arising out of January 6th by the United States Department of Justice have been charged under the federal insurrection statute. So it wasn't an insurrection. You're absolutely correct. I just think that the Secretary of State, and not just the Secretaries of State, to answer the second part of your question, you better believe they're communicating. This is an orchestrated nationwide campaign led by Democrats and some Never Trump activists, really to just harass the president. So yeah, they communicate.
Well, how can they look? I often say that I want, you know, a lawyer to sit next to me, and you know, on various things that we see on the news. But it's absolutely remarkable that we can have secretaries of state, and every secretary of state has access to a state paid lawyer or group of lawyers. Even they do it down to the legislative level, the city level. And they can look at law, or they can look at a situation and come away with such different conclusions. Help me with that.
Well, you know, that by itself, standing alone, is not out of the ordinary. What's a problem here is that allowing article or claiming that Article 3 of the 14th Amendment is self-executing is what allows this problem, this chaotic problem that you're referring to occur. So the Colorado Supreme Court decided that anybody could file a challenge to a person appearing on the ballot an Article 3 of the 14th Amendment challenge to anyone appearing on the ballot. And if that were true, then individual voters in any district, any judicial district, anywhere in the United States could file a lawsuit, and you would have court after court after court reaching inconsistent decisions, and it would be absolute chaos. And that
that's what we're looking at.
And that's one of the reasons the Supreme Court's going to straighten it out.
Well, I'm hearing that. You know, a lot of people that are paying attention to this, you know, some of these constitutional experts are all saying that it should be a 9-0 decision coming out of the Supreme Court. I'm not trusting that. Are you?
Well, I don't believe it will be 9-0. It'll probably be 8-1 or 7-2. But I am confident that the United States Supreme Court is going to put a stop to all this, and I'll elaborate on that if you would like.
Yeah, please. I mean, you know, people are fickle.
Yeah,
slippery.
You know, what you have to consider is the Colorado Supreme Court issued its decision on December 19th, and President Trump's legal team filed its application for review with the United States Supreme Court on Wednesday, January 3rd. So that type of review in a civil case is discretionary review, which means it's up to the Supreme Court as to whether or not they will hear the case. It's called a petition for writ of certiorari, which is an extraordinary writ. And the Supreme Court gets somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 of those types of, or those kinds of writs every year. And they act on somewhere between about 150 and 250 of them. So your average person has a very low likelihood of getting their case before the Supreme Court. But here, President Trump filed his application, or his legal team did, on January 3rd. By January 5th, 48 hours later, the Supreme Court not only granted the writ, they set the briefing deadlines and set oral argument for February 18th, 2024. So the parties will be arguing the case on February 18th, 2024. And I can tell you that in the 27 years I've practiced law, I've never seen the Supreme Court act that fast on a civil writ.
Yeah, I thought so too.
There are a number of studies that have been done, and the general consensus is that in 70 to 72% of cases, the Supreme Court reverses the lower court and grants relief to the party that applied for review. So you start out with the fundamental presumption that the court's probably going to turn this around, and then you put in the context of this case and the ludicrous nature of the Colorado Supreme Court's decision and the expeditious manner in which the Supreme Court has intervened. And I can tell you that the overwhelming likelihood is the United States Supreme Court is going to put an end to all of this and knock all these Article 3 14th Amendment challenges out.
Who, you know, because I'm stupid, although sometimes I feel like I could actually pass the bar, and anyway, when this goes to the Supreme Court, who argues the case on behalf of Colorado? Is it the state lawyer? Is it the secretary? Who argues that?
The actual parties,
yeah,
are the plaintiffs that filed the election challenge.
Yeah, I mean, who's going to stand there before those judges and say this is our case?
I have to tell you, on the side of the plaintiffs, that's not President Trump. On the other side, I don't know who their lawyer will be.
Well, that's the fascinating thing, because whoever it is on the side of the case against Trump, they just based on this whole premise, they can't be qualified to legitimately make a cogent argument, can they?
Well, yeah. I have to tell you, it was, if you and I had talked about this a year ago, I have to concede that I would have been wrong, because I found all of this so outrageous and so ridiculous. And I was absolutely convinced that there wasn't a court in the country that would endorse any of it. And, you know, time proved me wrong about that. And the Colorado Supreme Court's decision just literally blew me away. So I think that the plaintiffs, they have some non-sanctionable arguments to make. And the plaintiffs, meaning the individual anti-Trump people that filed their challenge, they have some non-sanctionable ethical arguments to make. They're just not very convincing.
When you argue before the Supreme Court, because, I mean, I don't think it's going to be an open hearing. I don't think we're going to necessarily get to see any of this, we little people out here. But it'd be a fascinating thing to, you know, maybe at least listen if we can't see it. How much time would they necessarily give? I mean, is the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, going to give them an hour or 2 hours, 3 minutes? What does that look like?
Well, that can actually vary depending on the number of parties and things of that nature. But ordinarily, the argument would be an hour each side.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's shortened here because of it, the nature of the claim, or whether they make it longer because of the political import of it, I don't know. You know, we'll have to wait and see.
How would you argue the case?
Well, I would start by pointing out this wasn't an insurrection in the first place. It doesn't meet the definition of insurrection for purposes of federal law. So that's it. There's no insurrection. Therefore, no one engaged in an insurrection, and no one can be disqualified no matter what. My next argument would be that that Article 3 of the United States Constitution's 14th Amendment is not self-executing. What that means is no one has a private cause of action. So in 1870, the Congress, let me back up. The 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, but Congress did not create a way to enforce Article 3. And to give your listeners and your audience some background, the 14th Amendment was passed, and Article 3 in particular as part of it, was to prevent former Confederates who had fought in the Civil War from coming back to Congress. Okay? So, but there was no way to enforce it. So in 1870, Congress passed the Enforcement Act that provided a mechanism for Article 3 of the 14th Amendment to be enforced. That was the law in some form or fashion until 1948 when it was repealed. So I would tell the Supreme Court that the ability to enforce Article 3 no longer exists without some action on behalf of Congress. So there's no insurrection, and even if there was, there's no way to enforce Article 3. And then I would point out that the president is not covered by Article 3 because the office of the president is not listed in Article 3. Mm-hmm. And they would have to read officers of the United States to include the president, and that's never been done before. In fact, there are a couple of Supreme Court cases that intimate that officers of the United States are non-elected officials. So it then, my argument would be, it doesn't cover the president at all.
Interesting.
And then finally, let's keep in mind that on January 6th of 2021, the United States House of Representatives was controlled by the Democrats, and they impeached President Trump for the second time. And if you pull up those articles of impeachment, they included this precise claim. Article 3 of the 14th Amendment, and they claimed that President Trump had engaged in insurrection, he had incited insurrection. They even threw in the official obstructing official proceedings under 18 U.S.C. 1512. And the problem is that President Trump was acquitted of those charges by the United States Senate. So the other reason that this can't be done is only impeachment can disqualify the president, and subsequent punishment is available under the Constitution only if the president's convicted on the impeachment article. So all those reasons are what I would tell the Supreme Court.
Now, do these judges on the U.S. Supreme Court, they all have, you know, their clerks. Are their clerks already preparing questions and or I don't want to say decisions because that's kind of like closing the door already, but kind of like a approach to when these arguments are heard? I mean, are they already being assigned to doing the research?
That's a good question. I can tell you this. Ordinarily, they would not. But, you know, what you have to back up and think about is that usually, and that's what's so extraordinary about what's happening here, ordinarily a party applies for the court's review in a civil case with a writ application. And the Supreme Court ordinarily meets periodically to review those, and their individual law clerks review all of those writ applications, and they ordinarily produce what's called a writ opinion, where they just tell the particular justice, hey, here's what I think, here's what this writ's about, here's what I think. And you got to remember, the Supreme Court's a policy court. They want to resolve issues of great import, issues where the lower courts are disagreeing with one another and things like that. So the clerks usually prepare these opinions, say, hey, we think this is a good case for you to look at, or it's not for these reasons or that reasons. And ordinarily that would be done several months from now. Mm. You know, 2 or 3 or 4 months from now, I'd have to go back and review the schedules, but they do it several times a year. So all of that process has just been turned upside down for this case. I wouldn't be surprised if the justices have clerks looking into the merits of all of this already.
Yeah, that's my thought.
But that would ordinarily be, that would be out of the ordinary in the usual case.
How many lawyers, send in, or how many states or custody, you know, whatever, send in friends of the court briefing on the posture to the Supreme Court? I mean, are they accepting a lot of that right now, do you think?
Oh, yes. Already, last I checked, there'd been 27 amicus.
27, yes.
Friends of the court. Yeah, friends of the court briefs are called amicus briefs. They were amicus that were filed about the writ application on behalf of President Trump, in support of President Trump. So there will be a massive number of amicus briefs. Now, there's a process that parties have to go through to file an amicus brief with the United States Supreme Court. And I can tell you that the Supreme Court's rules don't make it easy. So, if a lawyer who's never filed a civil writ application or an amicus brief with the Supreme Court wanted to do it, it could be done. But it takes an enormous amount of rule reading and research just to get the thing in the form that the court wants and all that sort of thing. So there are firms, that's what they do, is file writs, handle writs, and oppose writs, and handle amicus briefs, and they're going to be working overtime on this case.
And I would think they're already doing it now, for sure.
No doubt.
So there's, I understand this, Daniel Street, that there's kind of an ante room at the Supreme Court where a lot of, if you don't have room to sit in the court, you know, a lot of lawyers sit out in this other room and watch this thing. And I can about imagine you've got constitutional law professors and whatnot. I would imagine there could be a couple of hundred lawyers in there that show up the day of the hearing and watch this thing, that all have some kind of hope to have some kind of influence on the oral arguments. Is that true?
Well, there will definitely be a lot of interest and a lot of lawyers and professors and constitutional scholars and legal analysts and the media. For every one of those people, there will be four or five members of the media or more wanting to observe. I don't think they have any influence over the court's decision making.
Sure.
And this case is probably going to have as much or more interest than probably any case the Supreme Court
has
conducted argument on, at least since Bush v. Gore in 2000.
Yes.
So they'll probably have a lot of news media requests for access, and it'll be interesting to see what they do with that. The Supreme Court's been notoriously resistant to allowing technological advances to broadcast their oral arguments and things to the world. So This case will test their resolve on that, and we'll see what they'll do. I don't expect them to change the way they've been doing things personally.
How soon do you expect a decision from the Supreme Court? Can it almost be within days? Or, I mean, because they really have a short fuse here, do they not?
They do have a short fuse. Yeah, they do need to decide the case quickly. And that's where, once again, this timetable that we've been talking about is so out of the ordinary. Ordinarily, civil writs granted they've got this schedule about when the writs come in, when they consider them, when they grant them, then whenever they settle an argument, then when the briefs come out, and you would be looking at this case would ordinarily fall in October for decisions to be rendered.
Yes.
I think that's right. But there's no doubt they're not going to wait that long. Obviously, there'll be a lot to consider, and there'll be a lot of amicus briefs and a lot of people trying to weigh in on it. I would expect the Supreme Court to rule probably within about 6 weeks of oral argument. So towards the end of March, 1st of April, if they rule faster than that, it would surprise me, but stranger things have happened.
How much influence do you think the Department of Justice is putting out there right now with leaks and articles and, you know, things that are in the public domain, trying to sway the court?
Most of what the United States Department of Justice has been, their public statements and their leaks and things have pertained to the indictments, and less of the Colorado Supreme Court issue or the insurrection Article 3 14th Amendment issue. President Biden did make some public statements about it.
Yes.
But most of the leaks and most of the press conferences and things have been about other issues. I don't see much from the United States Department of Justice on this particular issue that the court is grappling with now. But there are some other issues at the Supreme Court that pertain to special counsel's, indictments of President Trump that those comments and leaks would be more germane to.
Is Colorado going out and finding a law firm and a top lawyer that will represent them at the Supreme Court, or do they think they're using one that's already on the payroll?
Well,
I asked that question because I just don't see that Colorado has anybody on the payroll, you know, coming out of the Secretary of State that necessarily qualified to make the argument to start with.
Yeah, I would expect, I got to tell you, number one, honestly, I don't know who will be arguing the case or even briefing the case for the Colorado Secretary of State or the plaintiffs. But the court itself, the Colorado Supreme Court, they don't have the ability or the right to lobby the United States Supreme Court about it. So they won't have a spokesperson presenting the Colorado Supreme Court's view of events. Their views are in their opinion.
Well, we appreciate Daniel Street, the insight that you have with what is happening here. You know, we don't have a lot of experience with arguments that are before the Supreme Court. And I guarantee us, you know, we hardly can ever read an opinion that comes out of the Supreme Court because they're generally pages and pages and pages and pages. And, you know, we just kind of throw up our arms and go, okay, whatever. But this one, I think, is, as you say, it's the most significant thing since 2000. I don't know how else to put it. But Daniel Street, Fake News Exposed on Substack. Daniel, thanks for this and carving out some time to share with, you know, your insight and your expertise on it. We need it, and I think it's huge. I mean, it's a pivot point, watershed legal moment here in the United States. So thank you, Daniel Street. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got more coming your way. Stay with us.
Victor deployed for the first time to Afghanistan in 2003. At 4 in the morning, my phone rang. They said, "I regret to inform you that your husband was wounded in action." Victor sustained a moderate traumatic brain injury. I was doing school full time, and I was also then caring for Victor. One of the most important elements of caregiving is taking care of yourself. I just didn't want to forget that I also had goals and that I also had a life. What I did is I challenged Victor to meet me halfway. There are almost 6 million military and veteran caregivers across the nation. We have our own journey, and we can fulfill that journey at the same time that we are helping our loved one.
Visit aarp.org/caregiving for a free military veteran's guide to navigate your caregiving journey and better care for your loved one and yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Gentlemen, we're so pleased you stayed with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. And I got the pleasure of having Scott McKay back with us. Scott is in charge of a book titled Racism, Revenge, and Ruin. It's All Obama. And I was kind of skeptical about this, and I've kind of, you know, been buying into it, but now I'm really bought into it. I think it is clearly Obama that's back there. But I think Obama's got a losing record here so far. This White House is desperate. But with that, Scott, welcome back. And, you know, you and I are going to go through this, I think, together with a little bit of slightly under the weather here a little bit. Hopefully it'll all go away. But welcome back.
Well, thanks. I don't know that I'm under the weather, but last evening, Jeff Landry just got inaugurated as Louisiana's governor. Actually, it was supposed to happen. We're recording this on Monday, I guess, and it's supposed to happen this morning. But we have like God's judgment descending down on us around noon today, apparently. And so they decided that they were gonna move the inauguration up, and it was, you know, 40 degrees outside and the wind was blowing, and, you know, inauguration ceremonies tend to last a little while. And, you know, before I knew it, I woke up this morning with a sore throat. So
yeah, that's how it begins.
I don't think I'm sick. I am not sick. I will. Okay, I refuse to be sick.
I believe you.
So I'm going to fight the good fight on this. But if I get a little scratchy, then, you know, that's my apology and excuse all wrapped into one.
All right. So we have now the fact that Obama tried to weigh in a very big way to keep Miss Claudia Gay as president of Harvard. Well, he lost that one. And Scott, they're really twisting up the argument here, or the reason why she was forced to retire or resign as president. She hasn't really retired because she's staying on as a professor, earning almost $900,000 a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, she checked all the marks to even have the job in the first place. But we're going to have to kind of battle this one, because the whole mess of Claudia Gay has not gone away, correct?
Yeah. And you know, essentially what they decided to do, since they had to punt on her, and understand that the entity we're talking about here is the Harvard Corporation. Which is basically the governing board of Harvard University, which is chaired by Penny Pritzker, who was Obama's commerce secretary, who's an old pal of Barack Obama's, from back in Chicago. The Pritzkers are the Hyatt hotel chain?
Yes.
That's their family fortune. I guess it's her brother is J.B. Pritzker, who's governor of Illinois.
Yes.
So these are like, you can't get any more, you know, ruling elite than the Pritzkers, who are in charge of Harvard, as well as these other things. And they are joined at the hip with Obama. So when Penny Pritzker and the rest of the Harvard Corporation decide that they've got a punt on Claudine Gay, that gives you a good indication of you know, where this is. Barack Obama came out and lobbied for her, but at the end of the day, that was too heavy a lift. And so the immediate pivot was that it's, you know, racists and, you know, bigots on the conservative side who have weaponized plagiarism against honest academics like Claudine Gay, which is like a breathtaking, you know, it offends the nostrils to listen to this. But this is the fallback. And that's a particular piece of logic that I'm going to blame Obama for, because you really didn't hear much of it prior to 2007 or so. He came along and I think, you know, turbocharged and weaponized this logical fallacy that anybody who's in a protected class cannot be criticized for things that they do, which have nothing to do with membership in that protective class. Otherwise, you're a bigot. For example, if let's say there's a female, maybe it's a left-wing activist, who posts something ridiculous on Twitter, and then you respond to that by, you know, noting how stupid it is, you immediately get accused of misogyny. This is this kind of thing happens constantly, right? Like, I mean, this is like the new sort of modus operandi of the left is, you know, you get people who are from sort of a DEI type background and they're completely immune from criticism. The problem is that the rest of the world just doesn't want to tolerate that. And it's, you know, we're becoming a little bit more strident in our opposition to it. Which is why, you know, these accusations of racism and homophobia and all these other different these things, you know, continue to mount. This whole thing was set loose when Obama became president, because I mean, it was, you know, people like Stanley Kurtz, who had done the research and tried to inform America what Barack Obama was about. And they canceled him. You know, they called him a racist. And he was like, well, this has nothing to do with the guy's race. It has to do with the fact that he's, you know, his background is full of communists that hate America, you know. And, well, you can't say that about a guy who's going to be the first black president of the United States. And when that happened, it gave, you know, gave bloom to these stupid allegations of bigotry on the part of people who were simply trying to analyze the merit of somebody like a Claudine Gay or somebody like, for example, Lloyd Austin, who is the Secretary of Defense under Biden, who, you know, goes into the hospital so that we are effectively without a Secretary of Defense for a week, right? with things happening all over the world that would necessarily command the Secretary of Defense's attention, doesn't even tell anybody he goes into the hospital. And you can't criticize that because he's black.
Elective surgery, not mandatory, elective.
Right. We don't know what it is, but it's elective surgery that went wrong. Well, exactly. But I mean, you know, so like the whole point is that you're not supposed to criticize Lloyd Austin because he's black, when he does something that anybody else who was Secretary of Defense would get annihilated for.
Well, he's also a general, so he knows the uniform code of military justice and what you can and cannot do. So
except he doesn't care. Right. See, this is the downside to this stupidity, which is that these people feel like they are above the law, they're above custom, and they can't be held accountable for anything. And this is a problem. I mean, like, this is how you destroy a country, is to completely lay merit by the side on behalf of essentially identity politics. And, you know, we talk about this a good deal in Racism, Revenge, and Ruin, how identity politics just completely swallowed up basically everything else in government and then metastasized into the culture and even corporate America.
Scott McKay, we hear about Russian oligarchs and we hear about Ukrainian oligarchs. And I would argue that we have American oligarchs. And I think that you have just listed a few, the Pritzkers, the Pelosi's, the John Kerry's, you know, the Obamas. There's something very wrong here. I think that we ought to start labeling these people oligarchs. What say you?
I have no problem with that. You know, we've had to some degree an oligarchy in America at times. You know, the robber barons of 100-150 years ago mm-hmm. were something of an oligarchy, but the difference with that was that, you know, those guys didn't actively seek to change the world through political means. For the most part, they were all about cornering the market in the industry that they operated in, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And when they got involved in, you know, sort of public facing things, it was generally speaking philanthropy, right? Like they would go build a museum or a, you know, theater or a zoo or whatever it might be. And that was the way they did philanthropy. The people who are kind of the modern day robber barons, you know, Mark Zuckerberg spends $400 million to fix the 2020 election by weaponizing local elections offices on behalf of the Democrat Party. That's not really something you would have seen out of an Andrew Carnegie or a John D. Rockefeller.
Touche. So we have flipped the script here a little bit. I would say that, you know, Russian oligarchs are for Russia. They're all for all things Putin. And if they toe the line. And I think our American oligarchs, that we've named some, and you rightly included Zuckerberg in there, Bill Gates. So it's almost as though they're toeing the line of some progressive green nonsense. So they all seem to march to a very unique progressive liberal ethos that, you know, is really does nothing for the benefit of America. I mean, I can't see where electric vehicles have benefited any part of the U.S. economy, for instance, or getting rid of gas stoves or gas-powered lawnmowers or
correct. I mean, almost in every respect, you know, whether it's the water heater thing or the right. You know, like you said, gas stoves or you know, your dishwasher that doesn't actually get your dishes clean. You know, and they tell you, go, well, you can just, you know, don't hand wash your dishes before you put them in the dishwasher because you're wasting water. And then, okay, I'll try that. And then I open the dishwasher and it's like, well, none of this is clean, right? And, you know, there's an absolutely phenomenal old video with Rand Paul tearing into, at the time it was somebody that worked for Obama, just tearing into him over toilets that don't do the job when you flush them. You know, and the guy couldn't believe that Rand Paul was going to take him to task over this. And he's like, you know, look, you guys screwed up household appliances. They used to work and now they don't. You know, and you're a crank if you even.
Didn't Trump even go over the whole thing about shower heads and, you know, there's not enough water? Do I remember that?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, this all comes from the same, you know.
So we have this kind of manifesto.
Mentality that, what's that?
Yeah. We have this kind of manifesto then that I think that they're all marching to, and that includes Claudia Gay. And I would say the other top leaders of these academic institutions, because I would say that Harvard, this whole thing with Claudia Gay doesn't begin and end with Claudia Gay at Harvard. You know, we've got Penn,
right.
We've got UCLA. You know, I think that we're going to see things like Georgetown. You know, we're going to see Colgate, Brown. I mean, you know, it just sort of permeates through the whole system. You know, it's its own progressive worm, correct?
Yeah. I mean, and this is all of these things, by the way, they're all justification for more and more elite control over regular people. And this stuff all fits together. And the thing is it's not really a conspiracy so much as it's a whole bunch of like-minded people who have climbed up into institutions that operate on the basis of sort of a pyramidal hierarchical command structure, right? Whether it's government, whether it's academia, even something like Hollywood, where you have a very small number of people at the top, who, you know, command everybody below them in a cascading fashion, right? Like you're not able to move up in these organizations without the favor of people above you. And, you know, that's how you can capture these institutions is, you know, you send people up the chain and they're able to build a cadre of folks below them that all rise together. And before you know it, that institution's been infiltrated and corrupted. And the only way to do this is you make competing institutions that perform better and simply displace the corrupted ones. But we're, you know, that's a project that we're at the very beginning stages of, if we've even embraced it at all. What you see is you've got this arrogant elitist mentality that is coupled with hard left politics. This is kind of it precedes Obama. It's been turbocharged mm-hmm. in the last 15, 16 years by the coming of Obama, who was able to direct federal money to institutions that were explicitly corrupted by the left, and then use those institutions to affect the ones that hadn't been corrupted by the left, you know, and that's how you get things like stakeholder capitalism and these woke corporations, as well as the complete destruction of any meritocracy or open debate in our academic institutions, going all the way down to the K-12 level as well. So,
well, it's permeated Hollywood. It's permeated advertising agencies. It's permeated, corporations that are entertainment corporations like Disney. If you take notes, sit back and watch TV. If you take notes of the TV shows and then the TV commercials, I hear Ron DeSantis talk about, you know, the schools are indoctrinating, but it really goes beyond that, because if we sit here and watch TV, we are being indoctrinated as well. The adults are. And so, they go wherever there is notoriety, wherever there is money, wherever there is, you know, some kind of public distribution. It's DEI. It's woke, right?
Yeah, well, DEI and woke are basically descriptive terms for something that's been going on, you know, for a very long time. I mean, the active ingredient here is critical theory, which is sort of a Marxist concept of, using culture to tear down a capitalist society. I mean, you know, these things are all sort of derivatives of that. This is something that we would not have embraced as a country if all of this had been laid out in front of us at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Instead, we got it sort of as a Trojan horse. We wanted to do something different, right? But the value proposition of Barack Obama was not per se the fundamental transformation of America. And that certainly wasn't laid out for the American people to choose. Instead, it was, hey, I'm going to solve the race problem in this country once and for all. And, you know, people like that because if you remember in 2007, I mean, race relations in America were at their zenith. I mean, it was like the best that we'd ever seen. And so folks thought at the time that, you know, we were on the verge of making race go away as an issue in America altogether. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And electing a black guy president would prove that this is not a racist country. Which was super attractive for people, and well, it should have been. Except, you know, you weren't getting a run-of-the-mill, you know, centrist politician that happened to be black. You were getting a red diaper baby who hated this country and everything about it and wanted to fundamentally, you know, morph it into,
mm-hmm.
yeah, into something that looks kind of like communist China in a lot of respects. And nobody would have chosen that. And it's one reason why all these years later, you've got such a malaise and such a, you know, demoralization among the American people.
Well, you know, it puts the little people outside the Beltway, it puts us at a real challenge here. And it's a real, you know, it's a tough lift to keep people from being indifferent. And I want people to be active and not just throw up their arms and just say, I give up, but, you know, it's too big for us. Because it's not. And, you know, there's a couple of people that really exposed Claudine Gay. She's, you know, burned herself at that hearing. But then people started looking at her in a hard way. And found, you know, all of these other issues. And so we do have the ability to fight back. And, you know, we have to fight back against Hollywood. You know, we fought back, I think, in a lot of ways against Disney with the help of DeSantis. You know, they fought back against Coca-Cola and, you know, what happened in Atlanta when they moved the All-Stars. You know, so there are some things that can be done, correct?
Oh, there's no doubt. And I think you're starting to see that the political machine aspect of the Obama project, you know, is kind of taking on water a little bit here. Mm-hmm. You know, they put a lot of eggs in the basket of sending Biden to Valley Forge to give a speech on Saturday that would, you know, launch or rejuvenate or whatever word you want to use to describe his campaign. And that was a disaster. I mean, that speech was very poorly, you know, poorly recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't give it well. I think it was a massive flop. And now you've got all these reports coming out that, you know, Obama, who, by the way, is still running the country. And if you didn't think that that was true last week, you are now excused and corrected, right? Is, you know, Obama is now demanding that Biden, you know, shift some people from the White House to his campaign and all of these different things because it's not working. And the next step is, you know, to find a way to jettison Biden from the ticket, which, you know, he may be Obama's puppet, but he does have a say. And Biden's like, I'm not going anywhere. So, like, they have that problem. They also have the problem of, unless he can convince Michelle Obama to jump in. And the thing of it is when I say jump in, it means get parachuted in at the Democrat convention, because they've already pretty much foreclosed anybody actually running in any primaries against Biden. So this is a coup at the convention that they would have to be plotting. And that's not easy to do. But if, you know, and worse than that, if you don't have Michelle Obama as your savior that you can parachute in, like, you're stuck with Kamala Harris, who you cannot sell to the American people.
Mm.
You know, so, like, they're at a little bit of an end game situation that, you know, they have to hope that some sort of way they can rejuvenate Joe Biden as a plausible puppet for, you know, the Obama regime. And, you know, I think most Americans have pretty much, you know, hardened our opinions on, you know, Joe Biden and his fitness for office. And, you know, which is why these guys are kind of scratching their heads about, well, I can't believe we can't sell Bidenomics. The economy's doing great, right? It's like, no, nobody's buying that.
Scott McKay, do you think that the Democrats, that the Democrat operation made a mistake by not embracing Robert F. Kennedy Jr. To kind of cultivate him and bring him along if there's nobody else and they have to necessarily default to somebody like Gavin Newsom or Michelle Obama?
Well, the problem is there's kind of the same problem with RFK Jr. that you have with Michelle. Which is, yeah. You can't tell him anything, right? Like, he's his own man. I mean, you know, Michelle doesn't want to be president. She doesn't like the work, and you can't tell her anything. So that's like a real problem to try to put her in as the nominee.
Right.
RFK Jr.'s, I mean, his thing is, first of all, they're very, very different kinds of Democrats, the Obamas and RFK Jr. RFK Jr.'s a liberal, okay? Like, he believes in civil rights. He believes in the First Amendment. He, generally speaking, has the same societal values that, you know, conservatives have. He goes about reaching those values in very different ways. But that's the old argument that you used to have between Republicans and Democrats. He's very much within that tradition. He's a Kennedy liberal. Obama is not a liberal, and the Democrat Party that has been taken over by the Obama machine, there's nothing liberal about them. They're not, there's no liberty in anything that they want. These are corporate fascist Maoists is really what they are. They're kind of, you know, cultural revolution communist type folks. Okay, they're for nonstop command and control of the economy, the culture, and the politics of the country. And that's not RFK Jr. So I don't know that you could front your organization with him because he doesn't believe the same things that you do.
Well, that's why I think, though, that in order to moderate them somewhat, they may have made a mistake and not, kind of coached him or brought him into the loop.
I think the mistake they made was back in 2020, when, you know, they essentially rigged the Democrat primaries so that Biden would be the nominee. You know, you had 24 people in the race, and Biden was, you know, barely top five out of that group, despite all the advantages in name ID and everything else that he had. And, you know, it was almost like a deus ex machina deal that, you know, that all of a sudden Joe Biden was their nominee when he wasn't actually winning any primaries prior to South Carolina. And of course, their initial darling that they'd raised a bunch of money for and everything else was Kamala. And nobody wanted to vote for her. So
dropped out before the primary.
Yeah, that's right. They threw in behind, you know, the two most reliable puppets they could find in the sort of arrogant belief that they could, you know, they could drag anybody over the finish line. And then they had to work awfully hard to do it because, left to his own devices, Joe Biden was not going to beat Donald Trump.
No.
You know, I mean, you had to resort to some very, very unusual and controversial and attention getting means to win that election. And so, like, it's even a heavier lift 4 years later when the record is out and everybody knows that this guy is a lousy president and that Kamala Harris is an implausible successor. So you're stuck with this. And how do you fix it? It's like, I don't have any good advice to give them because I think they've made their own bed.
I do too. Scott McKay. Racism, revenge, and ruin. It's all Obama. Thanks for this discussion, because I think that we have given the listeners an awful lot to chew on here. So thank you for this, and thank you for staying in the fight. I hope the sore throat goes away.
Thanks.
Yeah. And ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way in the Denise Simon Experience. Stay with me.
The conversation starter. This is Talk 92.1 WDDQ 8L Valdosta.